This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
If you enjoy Philosophy Bites, please support us. We're currently unfunded and all donations would be gratefully received. For details, go to www.philosophybites.com.
Will your judgment about the quality of the interview that follows be shaped by the fact that the interviewee is female? Sadly, even if you think of yourself as a feminist, the evidence is that it might well prejudice you at an unconscious level. So what are the philosophical implications of what's called implicit bias? Is it one explanation for why there are so few women in philosophy? Here's Jennifer Saul from the University of Sheffield.
Jenny Saul, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Hi, it's good to be here.
The topic we're going to focus on today is implicit bias. What is that?
That's a difficult question. The way I'm going to be using the term is to refer to a collection of largely unconscious associations that psychologists have shown over the last few decades pretty much all humans are prone to. And these are unconscious associations that affect how we perceive, interact with, and evaluate members of social groups in our societies. In particular, I'm especially interested in the way that they affect our interactions with members of groups that are stigmatized in our societies. Which groups these are will vary from society to society. Exactly what the associations are will vary from society to society, but it seems that pretty much all human beings are prone to these unconscious associations, which are really quite disturbing and which they may be totally unaware of.
Are you saying that I've got negative feelings, negative beliefs about particular groups of people?
Implicit biases are probably not beliefs. It's a very tricky issue exactly how to characterize these. But for example, it's been shown that most people living in a society like ours, which is racist in the way that's structured, will have unconscious associations about, say, black people, which are very negative. And this is true even of members of the stigmatized groups, even of people who devote their lives to fighting against these biases. So one example that's frequently discussed is that of Jesse Jackson, who's a very well-known American civil rights campaigner who's also African-American. And he tells a story of walking down the street late at night in an unfamiliar city and realizing that he feels relieved when he hears footsteps behind him and discovers that it's a white man. And that moment of realization and horror that he has this belief is the moment that he realized he had these unconscious biases, the association that was present in him that black people are dangerous or black men are dangerous, even though he's devoted his whole life to fighting against these associations. So these biases are something that we can be prone to, even if we're members of the groups of biases are against, even if we genuinely, deeply reject these biases in a conscious way, even if we devote our lives to fighting them.
What sort of scientific evidence is there to back this up?
Over the last several decades, there have been hundreds of psychological studies showing these biases in various ways by lots of different methods. The best known is the implicit association test. And this is best known because anyone can go do it online right now. I want to emphasize that it's not the only way that this has been shown, but it is the one that you can go try out yourself. So what the implicit association test asks you to do is to very quickly pair, say, black faces and white faces with good and bad adjectives, or women and men with arts and humanities versus sciences. And what they find is that the overwhelming majority of people will have great difficulty, say, pairing black faces with good adjectives. They'll be much slower at that and more prone to error than they are with pairing black faces with bad adjectives.
And how did you get interested in this? It's quite a specialized subject.
Well, I got interested in this because I was interested in understanding and doing something about the very low numbers of women in philosophy. So in the United States, women in professional philosophy are at only about 17%. The UK is much better in that women are at about 24%. But still, this is really quite surprising because most arts and humanities subjects are fairly close to 50%, and philosophy looks a great deal more like the sciences. In fact, there are some studies showing that it's more overwhelmingly male than even maths.
And the suggestion is then that there's some kind of implicit bias in the hirers who are not seeing the virtues of potential women philosophers.
No, the suggestion is a lot more complex than that, because implicit bias can come into many, many different sorts of behavior, either large behaviors or small behaviors. So, yes, one thing is that implicit bias has been shown to have a very large effect on hiring decisions. So if you present exactly the same CV with a female name versus a male name at the top of it, it will be rated as a better CV, more likely to be invited for interview, offered a higher rank, offered a higher salary if it's a male name than a female name. So it definitely does come into decisions at that level. And those are some very nice, clear, well-confirmed studies. The most recent of those is from 2012, so it's not dying out. The effect was shown equally strongly for all age groups, so it's not dying out in that sense either. It's not retiring out. Everybody seems to have this, and equally strong for both women and men. However, that's not the only place where it comes in. It affects the way that we interact with people, as I said. So both men and women will be more likely to call on men than women, more likely to charitably interpret some inchoate comment from a student if it's a man rather than a woman. They write better letters of reference for men than women, more likely to encourage men to continue in a subject than women. So it can come in all of these different points, which can have a very large effect.
This is really bizarre, because what you're suggesting is that philosophy is the worst or one of the worst subjects in this respect. But you would think, in terms of reflecting on the nature of belief and worrying about fairness and justice, that these kind of prejudices would have come to light and that we wouldn't all be wandering around with such dangerous biases that we're scarcely even aware of.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. Philosophers have, at least until recently, been very hostile to the thought that these biases might be creeping in. Part of this is our self-image as the most objective people around. It turns out that being even primed with objectivity makes you more prone to biases. Certainly reflecting positively on your own objectivity makes you more prone to biases. But fascinatingly, each professional group has a reason that it wouldn't be prone to biases. So the physicists will say that they're smarter than everybody else. The psychologists will say that they don't need anonymous review because they understand how all of this works. The philosophers say we're more objective. Everybody's got some reason that it can't be true of them.
Now, what is the philosophical interest in this? Because it's a kind of psychological and sociological interest which is important for philosophy as a subject. But there are philosophical questions that are brought up by recognizing the existence of quite widespread implicit bias.
There are a lot of philosophical questions raised by this. So some of them are about the nature of these things, whether they're beliefs, whether they're associations, whether they're some kind of quasi-belief. There are also lots of really interesting questions about culpability for these biases that are strongly affecting our behavior in ways that we find abhorrent, but we're not aware of it and we don't quite know what to do about it until we are taught by the psychologists. Most recently, I've been focusing on some implications for epistemology because I think it gives rise to something that's akin to a kind of skepticism, at least.
It's not obvious how you get from implicit bias to skepticism. Could you just take us through the stages there?
Yeah, I think people have tended to focus much more on the ethical and political consequences of implicit bias and trying to understand them in terms of psychology. But I think there are really important epistemic issues raised by them as well. One thing we know is that we're very likely to be making certain sorts of errors a lot of the time. For example, when we assess that CV, we're making an error about which CV is the better one because they're the same, right? But one of the nicest studies that I find most disturbing of implicit biases is actually not about gender or race bias, but about prestige bias. The psychologists took a group of papers that had been published by top psychology journals and resubmitted them to top psychology journals with fictitious names and fictitious, very unprestigious university affiliations. 90% of them were rejected. Now, they weren't rejected because we've published this before or that's plagiarism, which would have been extremely good reasons to reject the papers. Instead, they were rejected for serious methodological errors. So what we have in that situation is we have psychologists who are experts assessing something that they're experts on, the methodology of their own field, and going badly wrong either in the first instance or the second instance, either when the paper was assessed as publishable or when it was assessed as having serious methodological errors. One of those has to be a mistake. This, I think, should be tremendously disturbing to us. We know humans make mistakes. That's not a shock. We know we make mistakes if we're trying to do something that we're not very good at, if we're really drunk. You know, there are lots of circumstances when we expect to make mistakes. But this is making mistakes under what seem to be pretty ideal conditions. These are experts assessing subject matter in which they're experts. Presumably, not many of them are drunk. They're probably in a good state of mind for being able to assess these things well. And yet they're still making these errors. Now, the way that traditional skeptical scenarios work is a possibility is raised, which is meant to show us that we might be making errors of a certain sort. I might be mistaking a dream for reality. But I'm not actually given a good reason to believe that I am mistaking a dream for reality. Right? And then that's supposed to make me doubt whether I know that there is an external world out there. In the case of implicit biases, what we have is very good evidence that we are extremely likely to be making mistakes all the time as we assess the evidence that's presented to us, or the argument presented to us, or the person we're interacting with. Because usually when we're getting evidence or an argument presented, it's being presented by a person. And usually we can identify that person's social group, perhaps wrong about it, but we'll have some belief about what their social group is, and we'll be affected by that. So this shows not just that there's a possibility we're going wrong, but that we're extremely likely to be going wrong, and we don't know when we're going wrong. So although this can't lead us to doubt whether there's an external world out there, it's not that general, what it can lead us to do is not know exactly when these errors might have arisen. And it's stronger than standard skepticism in that we've got very good reason to believe we're making these errors.
How widespread is this?
Well, we don't really know for any of us which of our beliefs may have been affected by implicit bias, because most of our beliefs have been formed on the basis of things that people said to us. Now, sometimes it's because we're accepting their testimony. Sometimes it's because we think they've given us a good argument, or they've handed us some lovely evidence for a claim. And we just don't know what sorts of claims might be there. It's not just our beliefs about who to hire. It can be our beliefs about whether climate change is real. It can, you know, affect who we decide to believe on the street when we ask for directions.
But some of these biases are actually rules of thumb, as it were, which could be useful. There might be implicit generalizations, which may on occasion be shown to be false, but in general will hold.
The general capacity to make fast associations and act on those is a useful one, and we couldn't get by without it. But I think the tendency to think that a CV with a male name at the top of it is better than a CV with a female name at the top of it, I don't think that's useful in any way.
But that's different from looking at a paper that's come from the Harvard faculty, where you know the people who are writing the paper have been through a certain kind of process to get there, which is highly competitive, as compared with a minor college, as it were, where you don't know for sure whether the people are at the same academic level as the Harvard faculty.
Yeah, and if you weren't an expert in the field, that would be all you had to rely on, and that would be what you should rely on. But if you're an expert in the field, you shouldn't need that. You should be able to look at the methodology and make a judgment of that methodology.
So how do we get around this? Do we just end up as the kind of skeptic who says, well, I can't take anything on trust?
Well, another way that implicit bias skepticism differs from traditional skepticism is that it makes us feel a real demand for action. It's hard not to think, how do we get around this? How do I get past this? And you don't really feel that way about the dreaming skepticism. You don't really care that much. And the good thing is that there actually are things that you can do about this, unlike other kinds of skepticism. You know, if you want to know that you're making judgments of the quality of the work you're presented with, you make sure it's presented to you in anonymized form so that you're not being affected by the social group. And that's why the wonderful thing about the United Kingdom that I was absolutely shocked by when I came here is the widespread anonymous marking, which is totally unheard of in North America. Anonymous marking has been shown to result in higher marks for women. So this is a case where implicit bias has been successfully corrected for. Now, it can be much more difficult to introduce this for other things. You can't totally anonymize the process of hiring a lecturer if you want to know what they're like as a lecturer. You can't make them have voice distortion and lecture behind a screen. But you can anonymize parts of the process. So you can do long listing anonymously, where all you're basing it on is the publications. You can circulate anonymized writing samples as a part of the hiring process and get people's feedback on those samples without them knowing who the samples are from. So there are ways that you can improve your processes by anonymizing them further. But that's not going to affect everything. We need to improve our tendencies because not everything can be anonymized. Now, there are ways to improve that, but that's a little trickier. So one of the best things you can do is change the regularities in the world that give rise to this. So you want to stop assuming that women are less good philosophers. The thing you should do is have more women philosophers around. counter-stereotypical exemplars, which are members of the stereotype group who don't fit the stereotypes of the group, are tremendously effective in combating implicit bias. Feminist philosophers have sometimes talked about skepticism being a very individualistic philosophical problem that is limited in its capacity to engage with non-individualistic philosophy. But this kind of skepticism seems to require a non-individualistic solution. You have to change the society in order to change these regularities. And that's the only way to really bring it about that we're not being affected by these things. So you need to change the processes, but you also need to change who is in which positions in the society.
I've always thought of philosophy as a strange combination of arrogance and humility, the arrogance of Socrates to go and question people about their fundamental beliefs and say they might reveal to them that they're wrong about most of them or can't consistently defend them, but also the humility to recognize that you don't know all that much and you could be wrong about the things you know about.
Yeah, I think philosophers have both of those tendencies, and I think a bit more humility would be good for the profession.
Jenny Saul, thank you very much.
Thanks.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us.